Between the war in Ukraine, high oil prices, and the ongoing pandemic, the global supply chain is kind of getting it from all sides at the moment. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, March 14th. Good to have you with us. The war in Ukraine shows no signs of abating, and global supply chains are already showing the effects of sanctions and other disruptions in recent weeks. Now they're being further snarled by a more familiar agent of chaos, Omicron. The city of Shenzhen, a key Chinese manufacturing hub, is on full lockdown this week after recording a surge in COVID cases. Shanghai and other major cities are also under severe COVID restrictions. By American standards, China's COVID spike is relatively small. But China's zero-tolerance approach to the virus is nevertheless having a major impact on American companies. Marketplace's Matt Levin has this one.
The tech manufacturer Foxconn, which helps make iPhones and iPads, is shutting down its factories in Shenzhen for at least this week. That's obviously not good for Apple, but analyst Angelo Zeno at the consulting firm CFRA says the timing could have been worse.
If this were to happen, let's say, around September, October, or kind of around the holiday selling season, I think you'd have much more implications.
Some manufacturers in Shenzhen can temporarily relocate production to other parts of China. But if Omicron spreads throughout the country, what alternatives do companies like Apple have?
In the immediate near term, they really don't have much, to be honest with you.
Many U.S. firms are exploring longer-term plans to relocate portions of their supply chain to India or even reshore them to the U.S. David Dollar is a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says even if U.S. companies are reluctant to criticize the Chinese government publicly,
you know, I think privately they're telling the government that this is really hampering their activity.
Still, he doesn't expect China to relax its COVID policies before the end of the year. And when you add those to tariffs, sanctions, and now Chinese support of Russia,
quite a few U.S. businesses that are rethinking their relationship with China.
While China's strict COVID policies are hurting U.S. businesses, they could also hurt Russian ones. Inu Monik is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
There were rumors that, you know, China would help Russia economically. Well, if China's facing its own concerns, I don't know how much it could help.
Monik says lockdown Chinese cities could mean less demand for Russian oil and gas. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
So that's the impact of China's latest outbreak here in the U.S. and potentially in Russia. But what's it like in China? Our China correspondent Jennifer Pak is in Shanghai, where the financial capital is also restricting people's movement.
Shanghai doesn't call this a full lockdown. Officials haven't shut down the whole city, but they are sealing off individual buildings. The effect on residents is just as jarring. For days, friends have sent me news that their high-rises have been sealed overnight. Pet owners have formed chat groups and backup plans for how to feed their beloved animals if they can't get home for weeks. China's zero COVID policy means even if you're a contact of a contact and did not test positive, you still might have to quarantine at a government hotel. This strategy is how China kept its factories churning during the pandemic. But the Omicron variant is highly contagious. Here in the financial center, Shanghai, you can't leave the city unless you prove you're COVID-free and have a good reason to travel. Students are back to online learning, and parents, if they're lucky, work from home. As for people still going to the office, like me, the morning commute is quiet. Many restaurants are open for takeout only, and I carry my work stuff wherever I go, just in case. For now, still out and about in Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a mostly down start to the week for traders, but we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just over 2 years ago, the World Health Organization declared the COVID-19 outbreak a global pandemic. Since then, it's frequently been compared to the Spanish flu pandemic of 1918. But there are also parallels to a more recent pandemic. HIV/AIDS, which emerged in the early 1980s and devastated communities around the world. As Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, the HIV pandemic that started 40 years ago affected public health, public opinion, and drug research and development, similar to what we're seeing in the current pandemic.
COVID-19 has killed more than 950,000 Americans in 2 years. Since HIV/AIDS emerged in the early 1980s, it's killed about 675,000 Americans. The pandemics have one key thing in common, says Robert Wachter, chair of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco.
A virus that we knew nothing about in the beginning, causing tremendous panic and consternation in society.
HIV/AIDS was both mysterious and 100% fatal early on. But in part because of who HIV/AIDS infected most, gay men, public attention and government funding were slow to emerge. By the late 1980s, though, national health leaders were sounding the alarm.
The pattern is that it's clearly being established as a worldwide epidemic.
That's a younger Anthony Fauci, then and still now director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases.
People with AIDS won't be quiet!
It took a wave of grassroots advocacy and protest by gay men and their allies, directed in part at leaders like Fauci, to push AIDS research into high gear, says Wachter.
AIDS activism basically taught us the role of patient-centered and patient-driven activism in driving a scientific agenda.
New funding, new FDA rules and protocols led to revolutionary antiretroviral drugs that eventually turned AIDS into a manageable, survivable chronic disease for most patients. Fast forward to 2020, FDA and NIH were able to respond quickly and nimbly to the COVID pandemic, fast-tracking clinical trials and emergency use authorization for tests, treatments, and vaccines. Yale epidemiologist and AIDS activist Greg Gonsalves says the people leading the charge against COVID, like Anthony Fauci and current CDC director Rochelle Walensky, cut their teeth in the earlier pandemic.
All HIV veterans were leading agencies during the height of the AIDS pandemic.
And Gonsalves says there is a direct line between the funding and research, too.
Basic research, a lot of the sort of infrastructure for vaccine evaluation, investments in infectious disease paid for by AIDS research at the NIH really paved the way for our mRNA vaccines.
Gonsalves says there's one crucial public health lesson we seem not to have learned, that people who are marginalized and stigmatized in society will suffer the most and wait the longest for help.
In a certain way, it's deja vu all over again. You know, when the AIDS pandemic started, it was sort of a disease of disposable people, right? That it was gay men, Haitians, hemophiliacs, people that, you know, nobody wanted to pay attention to.
In the COVID pandemic, Black and Latino communities have suffered the highest case counts and death rates. Aisha Scott teaches Black Studies and Health Policy at Providence College. She says that's partly because of the low-wage, face-to-face service work they tend to do, and partly because of poor access to quality health care. Meanwhile, she says grassroots organizations that emerged in response to HIV/AIDS are again rushing in.
The National Black Leadership Commission on AIDS, which is now known as the National Black Leadership Commission on Health, has been tapped to help and get information to people in marginalized communities about COVID, the COVID vaccine, how folks can protect themselves. They've been distributing masks and different resources.
She says leaders from civic, religious, and community organizations have needed to step up to build trust and promote masking and vaccination because these marginalized communities have been neglected for so long. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Thank you. More than 2.8 million Ukrainians have fled their country since the Russian invasion began, streaming into Poland, Moldova, Romania, and other Eastern European countries. Some have already made their way to the U.S.-Mexico border seeking asylum. But while the Biden administration has granted temporary protected status to Ukrainians who were inside the U.S. without visas before the invasion, it has yet to formally welcome refugees escaping the war. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
When Eric Schwartz visited Poland last week as president of the advocacy group Refugees International, he heard harrowing stories from Ukrainians who had fled across the border.
One woman, her name was Nadia, showed us a photo of her children's school, which had been completely destroyed.
Another said friends of hers had been shot and killed in their cars while trying to escape.
A third woman in a town of Jeju told us of a bombing of a residential building next to hers, which occurred while she and her son hid in the bathroom of their home.
Schwartz says he was heartened by the response from Polish officials, aid groups, and individual volunteers helping Ukrainians find refuge in Poland and elsewhere in Europe. Under a temporary protection directive, the European Union will allow Ukrainians to live and work in member states for up to 3 years. The United States has pledged more than $4 billion in humanitarian aid to help Ukraine and other Eastern European countries cope with the crisis. But Schwartz and other advocates for refugees want the Biden administration to do more.
I am sorely disappointed that this administration has not yet shown leadership to welcome Ukrainian refugees to the United States.
Mark Hetfield is CEO of HIAS, a Jewish international refugee agency. He says in 1999, when Kosovars were forced to leave their homeland during the Kosovo War,
Vice President Al Gore went to Ellis Island and announced that the United States would take in immediately 20,000 Kosovar refugees, making sure that they knew that they would be able to return to Kosovo when it was safe to do so.
On Friday, President Biden said he would welcome Ukrainian refugees with open arms if they come all the way here. After those remarks, HIAS and other Jewish organizations sent the president a letter urging him to share responsibility with Europe. Hetfield says the U.S. should actively bring refugees here.
We need leadership right now for the United States to demonstrate that we're not just going to pat Poland and Slovakia and Hungary on the back for welcoming refugees, but that we're willing to do some of that ourselves, especially for those refugees with close family ties in the U.S.
And there are many with those ties, says Hans van de Veerd. He's senior vice president for resettlement, asylum, and integration at the International Rescue Committee.
There is a sizable Ukrainian community in the United States, and I think we expect to see family reunification. We expect to see Ukrainians coming as a refugee or through other legal pathways, and would also be ready to resettle them as well.
Any influx would come as the U.S. refugee system is still rebuilding from cuts during the Trump administration and struggling to resettle tens of thousands of recent refugees from Afghanistan. In the face of an ongoing national housing shortage, many are still waiting for permanent places to live. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we were surprised, we were shocked, we were bummed. It's very short notice.
Tends to be that way when things happen last minute. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 1 point, staying flat to close at 32,945. The Nasdaq dropped 262 points, 2%, to land at 12,581. And the S&P 500 fell 31 points, 0.7%, to end at 4173. We heard about some companies having to halt manufacturing in China because of the latest COVID surge. One of them, Foxconn, is Apple's biggest iPhone assembler. Apple fell 2.7%. The Hang Seng Index in Hong Kong closed nearly 5% lower today. That's the biggest drop since the global financial crisis of 2008. The plunge followed news that Russia is looking to China for military and economic help for the war in Ukraine. Bond prices fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.14%, and you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Here in Washington, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are putting pressure on President Biden to invoke the Defense Production Act to boost the domestic production of oil and gas. Many of us got a crash course in the DPA around this time 2 years ago at the start of the pandemic. Marketplace's Lily Jamali reports.
Over the years, the U.S. government has used the Defense Production Act, or DPA, to speed up access to all kinds of stuff, from rare earth metals for military systems to ventilators for COVID patients, all with the aim of protecting national security.
The DPA gives the president extraordinary powers.
But, says Eric Gordon of Michigan's Ross Business School,
it doesn't give him a magic wand.
Gordon says there's no switch that the president or anyone else can flip to boost energy production overnight.
No proclamation can make that happen faster than is physically possible. He doesn't have the power to suspend the laws of physics.
It's also not clear if this moment qualifies as a national emergency. That's a requirement for tapping the Defense Production Act, according to Jerry McGinn, a former acting deputy assistant secretary of defense whose portfolio included the DPA.
Yes, the price of gas is really high, but domestic oil production is not threatened.
But that production has to go through... yeah, the supply chain. And Julie Swan of North Carolina State says if there's anything the pandemic has taught us, it's this.
It takes a long time to make supply chains resilient, including for oil and gas.
With average gas prices topping $4.30 a gallon, proponents insist it's an investment worth making. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
Even as COVID numbers tick up in different parts of the world, here in the U.S., mask mandates and pandemic restrictions are easing. With that, more consumers are heading out and shopping. We'll get some insight into what they're buying when retail sales numbers come out later this week. According to an estimate by the Commerce Department, in-store purchases of clothing and accessories are already up nearly 22% from a year ago. But small businesses are still struggling to nail down exactly what people want to buy. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
Mary Bergstrom has been renovating her house in Brooklyn, and she's bought a toilet, lights, also sage to burn.
Oh yeah, to get all the juju out, for real.
Now that the essentials are taken care of, she's ready to buy things just for pleasure.
I've been doing a lot of shopping online, but it's not super satisfying. It's nice to be able to just go into a shop and see what there is and feel things and see them in real life.
That brought her to this shop called Jill Lindsay. It's named for its owner, who opened the store 8 years ago and wanted it to be a lot of things. Customers can buy some wine or tea along with a candle or a dress. They have events like kids' sing-alongs. One of the best-selling pieces of clothing this winter is an oversized cream sweater made of recycled wool. Lindsay says it originally cost $268, now on sale for $188.
It's like an aspirational piece. Like, this kind of knitwear is kind of antique looking, so it kind of makes you feel safe. Like, it's not aggressive.
That desire to feel a certain way has been motivating customers everywhere.
I do think there's a lot of emotional buying going on now.
Natalie Cutler follows retail trends for the advisory firm BDO.
It's the need to purchase something that'll make them uplifting, that'll make them feel better.
There's emotional need and there's also actual need, says economist Aditya Bhave with Bank of America.
There was all of these sales that were lost in 2020. We still need to wear clothes.
Bhave says small businesses stand to benefit from that need if they made it through the pandemic. Jill Lindsay says she got two federal loans totaling $86,000 to get her through. Since she's kept her space open, she wants people to linger in it again.
Now it's like, come in and go. Like, there's less of the hangout.
And Lindsay says if she's going to compete with big retailers like Anthropologie and J. Crew, people need to hang out and, you know, buy that sweater. In New York, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
We started off the show talking about supply chains, which, as Matt explained, are global in nature but can have decidedly local effects. Case in point, what's going on now with aluminum cans? The world's largest manufacturer of aluminum beverage cans, Ball, says demand is so high, it's raising its minimum order size. That new minimum is now so big that many smaller craft breweries say they can't meet it. As Matt Bloom from Colorado Public Radio reports, the supply chain hiccup has left many brewers scrambling for alternatives and raising their prices.
The inside of Denver Beer Company's production facility is bustling. Tall steel tanks hold batches of fermenting beer, which is then pumped into thousands of aluminum cans on an assembly line before being shipped to customers.
So last year we used about 6 million cans.
Patrick Crawford is the brewery's co-founder. He says canned beer sales soared when tap rooms shut down at the start of the pandemic. And it's still a big moneymaker. But late last year, Ball, his main supplier, told him they were dropping his orders.
We were surprised, we were shocked, we were bummed. It's very short notice.
Ball's new policy raises its minimum order from one truckload to five. For Crawford, that means he now has to order more than a million cans at a time for each brand of beer he makes, and find a place to store them all if he wants to keep buying from Ball. But his regional craft brewery can't handle that.
It's basically them telling us that they don't want us as a customer.
Ball declined to be interviewed, but in a written statement listed several factors for the change. It says there's been unprecedented demand for cans through the pandemic, and Ball says that inflation has hit virtually all the materials it uses to make its products. Since the policy was announced, Denver Beer Company and other breweries have had to scramble to find new sources for cans.
We're hearing that more than 1,000 total beverage companies were affected, but that includes soft drinks and kombuchas and other things that are in cans.
Bart Watson is an economist with the Brewers Association. He says can costs have gone up over 30% for some brewers that have switched suppliers, and many companies have delayed new releases.
When brewers are getting these huge cost increases, which aren't just in cans, but across the supply chain, you know, they have a choice to either reduce their margins, which, you know, you can only do so far until you're actually losing money, or pass some of that on to customers.
Ball says it's investing more than $1 billion in new can factories in five states to try to help meet demand. But the company expects the supply and demand imbalance to last a few years. Back inside the Denver Beer Company's distribution site, Patrick Crawford cracks open a can from the assembly line. It's a raspberry Kolsch called Princess Yum Yum. He says this is the last batch that will go into cans from Ball's manufacturing plant a few miles down the road.
And now we're buying a can that's either produced in Wyoming or maybe even in Quebec. And so our shipping costs are going to go up a lot, which is working a little bit of against what we're trying to do when it comes to sustainability, too.
He says his company will be able to keep store shelves stocked, though, which is the most important thing. But it'll cost customers. In February, the Denver Beer Company rolled out its largest price increase ever for a six-pack, up $2 from $9.99 to $11.99. In Denver, I'm Matt Bloom for Marketplace.
this final note on the way out today. You may have heard that today is Pi Day, March 14th being the equivalent of 3.14. I'm celebrating another moniker of the day, St. Louis Day. Since my hometown's area code is 314, the city has dozens of events planned celebrating all things St. Louis. So while you may choose to celebrate Pi Day with a delicious slice of pie, maybe try celebrating St. Louis Day with our specialty, gooey butter cake. And if neither of those options works for you, today is also National Napping Day. As CNN points out, napping is good for charging your batteries and boosting creativity. And since we all lost an hour of sleep over the weekend, we can probably all use a nap. Your moment of economic context on the way out today. We'll finish up with that other global supply chain story everyone's worried about, oil prices, which were down today, at one point dropping below $100 a barrel. That's the first time that's happened since the beginning of the month. The drop should, in theory, translate to lower prices at the gas station, since, according to AAA, the cost of oil accounts for about half of what we pay at the pump. Let's see if prices go down in reflection of oil prices as quickly as they followed oil prices up. Our daily production team includes Anais Amin, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.